Hopefully this CD works. Listen up next Thursday, 3 to 5. Every Thursday, Crimes and Treasons Radio.
I'm not listening to you. You only believe in science. That's probably why we never win.
We never win because you are fat.
Zoom a little zoom in a rocket ship. Off we go on a trip. Heading for the moon at a rocket clip. We're gonna zoom, zoom. Rocket, zoom a little zoom, now we're almost free from the Earth's gravity. Zoom into the moon at terrific speed, because there is no friction. Soon we'll see if the moon is made out of green cheese. Ha 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 ha. Zoom, we're here at the moon. Let's see what the moon is like.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to My Science Project. It's the Earth Day edition of today's show for 2007. I'm your host, Julia. So today we're going to take a kind of a different look at climate change and global warming, continuing on from what Anne discussed in her last show 2 weeks ago, all about science journalism. And today's show is going to encompass, for a large part, an interview that I did with Sir Harry Croteau, who's a Nobel laureate in chemistry, who won the award with other colleagues for his work on Buckminster Fullerene, or the Buckyball. And I played Harry Croteau's talk, Science, Society, and Sustainability, a few months back. He gave this at the University of Calgary. And I also was lucky enough to be able to interview Sir Harry by phone and to talk to him more about science as it's seen as a cultural and a social endeavor, and to chat with him about his ideas regarding the sustainability of science. So that's the tack that I'm going to take for this show, the idea that science is very much a cultural endeavor, and that I think some of the problems that we've seen with respect to the public accepting and understanding the complexity of climate change is a lot to do with differences in culture. For example, the language of science, the idea that things are very much couched in relative terms and qualified, such as there's a great probability that, rather than the absolute media sound bites that we get fed. There's this gap between how scientists think and speak and write, and how the rest of us, even scientists when we're not on the clock, discuss things. We're going to have these two parts of my interview with Sir Harry Croteau about science and a little bit about science and sustainability. And then I'll chit-chat about some other news and views that are climate change related. And following on from my interview, I'm also going to share with you some interesting things that are happening in terms of keeping science sustainable and making it more sustainable than it is, because scientific research is something that is extremely vulnerable in many ways. First of all, the credibility of science is something that's continuously debated, whether it's something like climate change, where there are people who have vested interest in denying the fact that human beings are responsible for the climate change that we're witnessing, to things like funding. And for the most of us working, let's say, in the public sector with science, it's tough. It's tough to get money. I think that science is at risk, and that's really unfortunate, because science is not necessarily the thing that will save us, but I think anyone would be a bit naive to think that we don't need science and technological research very much in the coming decades to help us cope with the social and ecological and environmental situation that we currently find ourselves in. So having said all of that, I thought I would kick off today's show by talking a bit about a report that was put out in February by the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And again, this feeds back into the idea of journalism and science and being very savvy when one is reading about various scientific matters, because there was a lot of really corrupt activity surrounding this climate change report. And this report was not a small endeavor. It involved the work of 2,500 scientists in more than 100 countries who came together to make what was a very exhaustive report. It really is the paramount scientific authority on climate change to date. And what this report said was very damning to those who believe that climate change is not happening, first of all, and second, is not generated by human activity. The UN declared that most of the temperature rise over the past 50 years had, quote-unquote, very likely been caused by human activity. And by very likely, they mean a certitude of more than 90%. By 2100, the report suggested that global average surface temperatures could rise between 1.1 and 6.4 degrees centigrade, depending upon how much CO2 was released into the air. They also suggested in this report that greenhouse gases disgorged by us during this century would cause climate disruptions for more than a millennium, so 1,000 years, because of the length of time that it takes for the molecules to degrade. And it was from this report that Jacques Chirac, the French president, famously said that, quote, we are on the verge of the irreversible. So this report was not anything to sniff at. And in fact, Achim Steiner, who is the executive director of the UN's environment program, said that this climate change report was basically the last word in whether or not climate change was happening and that we were causing it, and that this would then allow us and our governments to put this issue and this debate to bed and to then go forward and to act in a positive way about the situation. We are way past the point, and I think we have been past the point for decades now, but as a society we have come to a point where we really need to stop talking about whether or not it is or it isn't happening, and we need to start acting about it. And even if it's not due to us, let's just say for the sake of argument, all of the things that we need to do anyway are good changes to make. The idea of not wasting things, the idea of making our lifestyle sustainable, the idea of not being quite so greedy. These things, we should probably be doing them anyway. So the bottom line is, this change is good, and we should be making it fast.
If it weren't for the birds, remember my pet, the balance of nature would be upset. The insects of the world would surely double, and the people of the world would be in trouble. The balance of nature is ever unbalanced. Whatever will happen will not be good. If it weren't for the snakes, mice would multiply. And without the algae, the fish would die. The flowers and the fruit need pollination, and the balance of nature consideration. If the balance of nature is ever unbalanced, whatever will happen will not be good. If too many trees are chopped down, we have floods and soil erosion and a reduced water supply. If too many plants are destroyed, the animals may not have enough food and oxygen. If too many animals are killed, the minerals and carbon dioxide that animals supply to plants will be diminished.
The balance of nature must not be unbalanced. The balance of nature should be understood.
If the balance of nature is ever unbalanced, whatever will
I watched a BBC documentary on climate change just the other day, and they were saying that based on the current levels of our activity, we would need to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions by 7 times what is estimated to be pumped out into the atmosphere. And to put this into context, if everyone who owned and operated a car was to swap to a hybrid vehicle, this would only account for one fold or one part of a decrease. And when you think about the likelihood of everyone on this planet switching to a hybrid vehicle, it's really terrifying. And I am not at all suggesting that we should give up and do nothing because it seems so overwhelming. I would argue the complete opposite. But it puts into context the challenge that we all face, and that everything that we can do as individuals is a good thing. And it doesn't all have to be the same thing. And different people have different abilities and situations that they need to make their changes to suit. So there's not a one-fit solution, but we've all got to start pitching in. So it's easy to get depressed and it's easy to get really terrified by it, but it's also a really exciting and really inspiring opportunity for us to actually do something quite amazing here. But getting back to this UN report, the U.S. response, the government's response to this was interesting. It said that the report was, quote, very valuable, and again, quote, unquote, conclusions of the report are significant, but it offered no sign that George W. Bush would shift the focus away from voluntary and technology-driven initiatives to tackle climate change. And these initiatives are actually really funny in a really scary way. For example, something that was published by The Guardian in January of 2007 suggested that when the U.S. was given a draft of this UN report, because the UN submitted a draft to various governments before it released the final report, and the U.S. government contested it from the get-go, they tried to steer it away from conclusions that would support a new worldwide climate treaty based on binding targets to reduce emissions. Even more, the U.S. complained that overall, quote, the report tends to overstate or focus on the negative aspects of climate change, unquote. And even more insulting, the U.S. government wanted the report to focus more on the responsibilities of the developing world to combat climate change. And this is insane when a recent article in Scientific American about hydrogen fuel cited that U.S. vehicles alone consume 383 million gallons of gas a day, which is about 140 billion gallons of gasoline each year. That's just vehicles. That's not anything other than just stuff driving around on the highways. And that number accounts for about 2/3 of the total national oil consumption of the states. Now, I don't have all the figures for, let's say, comparing American emissions versus China's emissions. I know that there are other countries, as do you, that are snapping up cars left, right, and center. But the idea that this country, which has so much responsibility, is trying to pass the buck is shameful. And I'm sure that there are many Americans who feel equally enraged by the response of the U.S. government, their government, to this report. What was really hilarious about this were some of the ideas that the U.S. government was suggesting as alternatives to combating climate change by lowering emissions. And this was to basically reflect light away from the planet, to reflect the sun's heat off of Earth. Now, previously, scientists had estimated that reflecting less than 1% of sunlight, which is a small amount, back into space could compensate for the warming generated by all greenhouse gases emitted since the Industrial Revolution. I don't know about the science behind this. I don't have further details, but this is what The Guardian is reporting. Picking up on this, the U.S. suggested various techniques, such as launching thousands of tiny, shiny balloons, or several reflective mirrors, or putting a bunch of reflective dust particles into the atmosphere, which is really insane when you consider the expense and the uncertainty of it. And in fact, this IPCC draft that the UN put out about climate change stated that such ideas were, quote, speculative, uncosted, and with potential unknown side effects. So this is appalling. But let's go one further, shall we? Let's get even more irate about this whole ridiculous treatment of this report by the U.S. administration. And again, I must say that Canada could do better and other countries could do better. And I'm picking on the big guy because it's easy to do. But it's stuff that we need to be aware of because it affects us directly. And as I said, Canada's not exactly spotless when it comes to our actions. So we need to be aware of this kind of crap going on because we need to make sure that we don't end up being guilty of some of this behavior. In February 2nd, the same day that this IPCC report was launched, The Guardian also reported that scientists and economists had been offered $10,000 each by a lobby group funded by Exxon called the American Enterprise Institute, which is an ExxonMobil-funded think tank with close links to the Bush administration, that offered these scientists and economists to undermine the IPCC climate change report. Now, in addition to the $10,000 to write bad print about the climate change report, travel expenses and additional payments were also offered by the American Enterprise Institute. Now, the AEI has received more than $1.6 million from ExxonMobil, and more than 20 of its staff have worked as consultants to the Bush administration. As I mentioned, Canada needs to be aware of this because in the same report in The Guardian, they noted that another Exxon-funded organization based in Canada was going to launch a review in London, England, to also cast doubts on this IPCC report, and included other high-profile people, including, interestingly enough, Nigel Lawson, who is Nigella Lawson's father and a British MP. So all really scary and all really bad, and it emphasizes the need for the public to be informed and to think critically about science and technology, the need for scientists to speak out and to be vocal about what they believe in and know to be true according to their data. After that diatribe, this is the first part of my interview with Sir Harry Croteau. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, My Science Project. If you want to get in touch with myself, Julia, or my co-host, Anne, please email us. It's myscienceprojectradio@yahoo.ca. So I'm speaking with Professor Sir Harry Croteau, who's a Nobel laureate in chemistry. Sir Harry, welcome to My Science Project.
My pleasure.
In 1996, you received a knighthood for your contributions to chemistry, and later the same year, you were awarded the Nobel Prize in Chemistry, along with Robert Curl and Richard Smalley, for the discovery of the C60 molecule Buckminster fullerene.
Yeah.
Not a bad year.
No, some years are better than others.
Now, something that perhaps is at least as dear to your heart and as important to you is your Vegas Science Trust, which champions and celebrates effective science education through TV and internet broadcasts.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the Vegas Science Trust for us.
Well, some years ago, quite a long time now, over 10 years ago, I started to record scientists giving lectures. I decided that there were people who were excellent at this and could transmit the enthusiasm and passion and also concerns of science to the public, and I thought it would be a good idea to record them. And I did that for television, BBC television at first, and then the whole thing grew, and I've experimented in other sort of ways of communicating. But basically, the idea for the Vegas Science Trust was to create a platform for scientists to communicate directly with the public and also with scientists, or whomsoever they wished, on whatever subject that interested them, but also for the public and other people to see scientists as they were, rather than the caricatures that one sees in the media. And so in the end, I have sort of half a dozen or more different approaches, and the first one was a set of lectures. The next one were interviews, in-depth interviews with scientists. Then there were careers programs called Snapshots and discussion programs where we actually got people together talking about subjects they knew something about, which was a new concept for television. And then just more recently, we got major issues of concern, such as politics and science and also malaria. And those sorts of issues are turning up. So it's become a sort of wide-ranging platform for scientists to say things about issues and science and get people interested in what they have to say rather than through the medium of someone who doesn't really understand the subject.
So you mentioned breaking down the stereotypes of scientists and getting scientists to say directly what it is that they're doing and what they find important in their research. And I think that's a nice segue into the question I'd like to next ask you, which is, what do you think needs addressing in terms of science education and the public understanding of scientific research to be really effective?
Well, I think there are a number of issues. There's an assumption that you can understand science without doing some work yourself. I mean, I think it's much more of a problem than people appreciate. I mean, science is not just about the applications of science, which, of course, the public are perhaps most interested in. What will it do for me? But it's actually a cultural sort of career. It has some meaning of itself in the same way that writing and music has importance and has cultural value and intellectual aspects. And I think that's something that's neglected and not really appreciated. To understand that, you have to learn something of the language of science to really get a feeling that it's not just there as something useful for society. It actually has a recognition that it has value intrinsically, even in the absence of direct applications. Knowledge about the universe and about nature and the physical world is perhaps everything that we could possibly want to know, and that's important independent of applications. But to appreciate that on that level requires some work on the part of the person who wants to understand that or who should understand that. And just as one really, if you want to understand Japanese culture, you would have to learn Japanese. To some extent, you have to learn something about mathematics, and not necessarily a large amount, but some feeling for it to really appreciate the cultural aspects of science. If one, on the other hand, just says, okay, it's just a useful thing and it's helpful, this, that, and the other, and it's only science is only of value when it's useful, I think it denigrates the subject and you lose respect for it. And that's, I think, what has happened in the latter part of the 20th century and the early part of the 21st.
And what do you think that is? It's sort of a hairy question. I know that you have strong views about how scientific funding is distributed now, and I wonder how we can justify to people, doing science that we love to do, that we think is incredibly interesting, that could potentially lead to technical applications, but...
Yeah, I think one has to realize that it's a creative pursuit, and it's... that many young people, when they're being creative, are not really thinking about what the value of it might be or how much money they will make. They do it because they love it, and that is a very good area for actually doing something quite imaginative or that wasn't done before. So, as I said before, science is an area where one has various aspects. It has just this. In fact, science is not just applications, as I said before. It's the method of how science works, how we discover new things, and on top of that, it's the actual knowledge. So there are at least three aspects: the fund of knowledge of our understanding of the universe, and the applications are there, of course. And by and large, that's all that people ask about. What's the use of this thing? They don't really ask what is the intellectual fascination that you might have. They don't ask that question of a musician and take it for granted that it's a cultural thing. They feel that music is good for the soul, but science is only useful and good for the soul if it's useful in curing something or this, that, and the other. And I think we have to get over that and get our young people to realize that it's an amazingly exciting area for young people to get into and from an intellectual point of view. The funding of science, of course, is very often related to the perceived value that science might have. And that's a problem because the most, well, not always, but very often the most important breakthroughs are made in areas which are totally unsuspected. I mean, if you, for instance, thought of such things as the laser, no one would have predicted before the laser was invented that it might be useful for eye surgery. Okay, that's just totally out of the question. The platinum anti-cancer drugs, which have saved a lot of lives, were made 100 years ago just because the guy was interested in what are the properties of platinum compounds. And science abounds, is just teeming with those sorts of examples, and yet no matter how much you remind the funders of science of this, they can't pick themselves up very easily and say, well, we should just fund brilliant young people to do what really excites them. And historically, we know the most important and exciting and unpredictable advances come from that area.
Now, with your Vegas Science Trust, and similarly with this show, with my science project, it's aimed at sharing science and along the way educating and interesting people who are not scientists in the process of science and how science can impact on their lives, either negatively or positively. And I wonder if you've been able to measure at all sort of the impact of the Vega Science Trust on people in Great Britain or people around the world, because it's available online.
Well, I mean, first of all, the programs, we made over 110 programs, and 55 have been shown on the BBC. They're shown four times, and then they get onto our website, and then they're seen worldwide. And we have very good statistics, although there's no advertising at all, that we're making an impact, because we have the feedback for people who most... 2 days ago, I got one, said, I don't think I'll leave my house again now I've discovered your website. So we have those, that sort of continual anecdotal evidence. We're a very small site, I mean, by comparison with what's out there. But what we do have is quality, and that quality comes through. I find people want to use our material for teaching, and that's very gratifying. To some extent, I'm now working on a much less expensive way of doing this. There's new technology out there which allows me to make programs very inexpensively. The programs that I've made up to now, my colleagues with Vega, have been really quite expensive, because they've been designed as television programs initially, and then after having been shown network television, they're then posted on the website, and then they're available free for view worldwide. And I want kids in Japan or in Africa or in India to be able to see great scientists giving lectures or talking or being interviewed, and also careers program, what it's like to be a scientist, or what it's like to be a technologist, what it's like to do research into malaria or into ecological problems, or make a submarine which goes under the Antarctic. We've got all those programs on our site, but they have been rather expensive, and I'm now moving towards a view that the internet is this incredible new technology which enables me to make very inexpensive programs which are available globally. And I've just set up a studio here in Florida where I and my colleagues will be making programs to some extent to order. We're going to experiment. It's a new period. It's like television was in the 40s and 50s. We don't know quite how it will be most effective as far as science is concerned. So my initial idea is, let's get teachers to get their kids to ask questions, and we'll make a little short modular program to try to answer those, and then perhaps be online for discussion after them. So these are very early days in this exciting new internet video technology.
It's fantastic to have discussion forums with school children and chat rooms and such.
Well, I've already done this. I mean, I just last week made a presentation to Oxford in England from Florida. And the feedback was really excellent. The teacher said it worked. The technology worked like a dream. They were apprehensive at first. Said the kids were unusually attentive and really appreciated the issues that I brought up. In fact, it was electrical science, society, and sustainability. The issues that I think young people need to address, and that we need these huge numbers of smart young people to solve some fundamental problems. And then it said not only were they unusually attentive, but it opened our eyes to this new technology and what can be done. So I think we we're on to a winning sort of streak here. And in fact, we have a meeting this afternoon to put in place a program of projects for next semester.
Now, before I go on to what I'd like to be, I guess, the last part of our interview, I wonder if you could give us the Vega Science Trust website so everyone can visit.
Yeah, Vega website is www.vega.org.uk. And in fact, all you need to know is Vega, V-E-G-A, and put that into Google, and you'll find the Vega Science Trust on that, if you can't remember the full thing. Okay.
And everything there, all that material is for free. Totally viewable.
Absolutely,
yeah,
yes.
Absolutely accessible.
It's not downloadable, but it's a viewable free because I, we want to keep some sort of possibility of survival because it's just run on a shoestring, actually. That site, everything is covered. And although some of the programs cost £20,000 an hour, and in fact the careers programs cost £17,500 for 15 minutes, they've just won an award. They're called snapshots. So any young person can look at those, something like a dozen programs, and get an idea of what it would be like to have a career in the sciences, engineering, biology areas, but a lecturer at a university, you name it. So it's all freely available.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Hey, and welcome back to My Science Project, the show all about science and technology. I am your host, Julia. This is a pre-recorded show, just so you know. I'm recording it from Calgary, sending it to you. Anne is live, though, every other week. So if you need to give her a call, you can do. But if you want to get in touch with either Anne or me, email us at myscienceprojectradio@yahoo.ca, please. We just finished listening to O Green World by the Gorillaz off their Demon Days album. And the short song I spun before that was off the Singing Science Records called The Balance of Nature, a classic. The theme of today's show is all about Earth Day, April 22nd, and climate change. Now back to the second part of the interview that I did a few months back with Sir Harry Croteau.
You mentioned your talk, Science, Society, and Sustainability, and it's something that I'd like to pick your brain about, because we think of sustainability and the way the world is going in terms of the resources that we use in the context of using up things like fossil fuels and not being able to drive our cars and all the rest of that. But it seems that there's not a lot of attention being paid to what's going to happen with scientific research, which is hugely dependent on petroleum products.
I think you're right. I mean, what people don't realize is that everything is dependent on petroleum products. Everything in the room, the adhesives, the paints, the plasticizers, the computers, you name it, all the materials that we have sort of developed in the last 50 years come from petroleum products, almost everything in the room. But that's not all. We use petroleum products to produce our food. I mean, 70% of the world's food is produced by Haber-Bosch nitrogen, and that is basically hydrogen from fossil fuel, and it's also heat in the catalysts that make the ammonia uses fossil fuel. There is no part, or our packaging uses essentially fossil fuel to make the compounds. It's actually criminal to burn this thing when it's actually so valuable and so important to the raw materials. Every plastic bag you take from the supermarket is actually using this up. Every time you fill up your gas tank, you're pouring dinosaurs and pterodactyls into the gas tank, and it can't go on, because basically we use about 1 million years worth of fossil fuel every year. It took a million years of animals living, dying, and sort of decaying to make the fossil fuel that we use up in 1 year. And so people just think it's the stuff that goes into the gas tank, but it powers the air conditioners, it powers the electricity that we get in the light, it powers the refrigerators, and it just can't go on. So on top of that, of course, we've got the carbon dioxide problem and the climate change issues to contend with. But those are just a few of them, and I think we need to make some fundamental advances if we're to produce energy or store the energy from the sun, which is what we have to do, at the same rate as we're using it. Now then, I think obviously a lot of people have looked at this, and I'm not a big expert, but I can see there are problems, and we have to buy time by, you know, trying to conserve, to try to find alternative renewable sources. But possibly we may have to make, and I'm one of the people who feels it's probably necessary to make some fundamental advances if we're going to continue to use energy at the rate that we're using it. And by fundamental, I mean an advance that we haven't made yet. You know, so something that some technology which is not yet in place.
Like fusion?
Well, that's a possibility, but it's looking tricky, because, I mean, when I was at Bell Labs in the 60s, and I was a brain drainer from the UK, and they wanted to get me back, and I was offered a job on a fusion program in the UK. And they told me it'll be about 30-year project. And I thought, well, I might be dead by, by 30 years looked like a long time when I was 27. And at the same time, I decided not to do that. But I'm now looking at the prognosis for fusion. It's 36. It's 36 and 40 years. So it's now, 40 years later, and it's now even longer in the future than it was when I was looking at to get a job back in the UK. So that's a tricky problem. And but my guess is I've said this in my lectures, that the possible holy grail in this area is splitting water into hydrogen and oxygen with sunlight. That requires two photons and two light particles to break the hydrogen oxygen bond in water, which is a good thing that it requires two. If it only required one, there wouldn't be any hydrogen and water around, because they would have all been split into hydrogen and oxygen, and the hydrogen would have left the Earth because it can escape from the Earth's gravitational field. But it does require two, and if we can solve that problem, then we might be able to make a fundamental impact in the use of fuel. And if we can split water into hydrogen and oxygen and then burn it back to get the energy, then we wouldn't have the carbon dioxide problem, because it would just give us water back. Of course, that would require water, and that's a massive problem too. I think most people in the sciences and technologies realize that one of the great problems that the world faces is the fact that, water is around, but it's not always in the most important places.
Do you think, because it's always a fight to get money to do good science, that science might actually be particularly at risk because the governments might be the first to pull scientific funding?
Well, I think that's almost certainly true. It's always a fight to get. It always has been. It's a fight now, and it was a fight when I was starting. I mean, if people tell you sob stories about getting research money, I can give you much as tough as anybody when I got started. And took many years, and I think it's very tough on young people now. I mean, I was very fortunate to have got tenure almost immediately. I got back to the UK, whereas the young people, particularly in the US, are under tremendous pressure to produce results very, very quickly. And I think under the U.S. scheme, I probably would not have survived and probably would have gone off to do something else, because it took me 7 years to get my act together. But the pressure I put was on myself rather than the pressure from outside. So I feel very strongly that to do good science, you need some freedom of the mind. It's not easy to do good work under the sort of pressure that young people who might have a family and a child, and then they have to pull work, 48 hours a day to get research going and get papers out and get research proposals in and all that stuff, and then convince whoever it is that they're doing good science just to keep their job, and they've got teaching and administrative loads. It's quite tough for young people at universities now, but there are bright young people who want to do it, and some of them survive, which is pretty good for the educational system.
Right. So is there a way that you see that, other than lobbying and kind of doing what we're all doing and fighting the good fight to do our work, that we can try and bring to the public's attention the fact that, science is critical and the governments need to support it, especially in light of peak oil and all that?
Well, I think there's a total disconnection from reality. Just let me find it. I've got something on my desk, which I think brings it into some sort of focus. Well, I don't know where this came from, but a student handed it to me, and the numbers don't look a bit amazing. So the developing world now spends $13 on debt repayment for every $1 it receives in grants. But then the world spends $780 billion on military spending. Okay, and only $6 billion on basic education for all. Now, I'm guessing that I'm not sure what that means, but the numbers are gigantic, that the $780 billion on military spending. Okay, there's something wrong there.
Yeah, it just makes you sick.
I mean, when did you ever want to buy an F-111 fighter or an atomic bomb? And if one wants to see where the problems lie, it's the huge investment in military spending that the world has. And I think this is you know, small amounts of those money will make a big difference in education. I mean, if this number, $780 billion, this must, I don't know what, $6 billion on basic education. I don't think that can be correct, but never, I think the U.S. spending is on education, well, I don't know what it is, but it's probably in the tens and twenties. But it's definitely way down from military spending. So small amounts of that moved into fundamental science area probably will pay vast dividends in fundamental advances. My memory was that something like 14% of the total research budget of the USA was spent on fundamental research, and something like, 84% or so, 85% was spent on targeted applied research. Now, I know that that was cut in the UK, I mean, which also had a similar percentage, but, you know, cutting 5% down to 10% is a massive change in fundamental science, and is, if you move that over to the applied science, the difference between 85 and 90 is really nothing. You know what I mean?
Absolutely, yeah.
And so I'm really a very big supporter of fundamental science. That's I would be, wouldn't I? I mean, but by and large, there are people who can do fundamental science, and there are people who can do applied science, and there's a whole range of between those two. They're sort of on the from one end of the sort of research sort of philosophy spectrum to the other. And I think, by and large, if one looks historically, some of the most exciting advances and the most important key breakthroughs have been made in this area of fundamental science. And if that gets below the threshold of viability, then that will be a problem.
Well, Harry, I know you're a busy guy, so I will let you go. And I thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me today.
My pleasure.
In a jet plane, hot gases shoot out of the back of the engine at great speed. Energy for the motion of the gases is supplied by the burning of fuel. The action of the rushing gases causes an equal and opposite reaction, which sends the jet plane forward.
And that's how a jet plane flies. The law of motion applied to jets is simply action and reaction. The zooming power the engine gets is simply action and reaction.
The gas compressed inside the engine pushes out in all directions. Sideward thrusts are equalized and can't escape from the jet. Gas exhausted through the engine brings an opposite reaction, gives the jet its forward thrust. That's all there is to a jet.
The law of motion applied to jets is simply action and reaction. The zooming power the engine gets is simply action and reaction. Newton said it, give him credit, his law of motion still applies.
For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction.
And that's how a jet plane flies.
That was the second part of my interview with Sir Harry Croteau about sustainability, and we just finished listening to a song called Jets off the Singing Science Records. And I played that song because one of the things that I don't think has received a lot of attention and deserves more is the alternatives that we need to come up with for sustainable air travel. Basically, taking a jet is the equivalent of burning the same fossil fuels if you were to drive that equivalent distance. So it's not like taking a bus where you're conserving energy by sharing the vehicle with other people. It's incredibly expensive to fly airplanes, not just in terms of the ticket cost, but in terms of the resources used. But one article that was reported last August in Scientific American brings us a little bit of hope. And this is where researchers were able to fly an unmanned aircraft vehicle on a hydrogen fuel cell. They were only able to get it off the ground for about a minute, but this is kind of optimistic in that the Wright brothers also got their first aircraft off the ground for only about a minute in length and up to an altitude of 8 to 12 feet. one of the challenges for having planes that are fueled with compressed hydrogen is the storage of the hydrogen. Hydrogen, for one thing, is very tiny, and the atoms tend to leak out of storage containers. It's also the amount of hydrogen that would be required to fly a jet plane, for example, across the Atlantic. So there's lots of things to be ironed out. Those are just two of the most pressing problems. But when you consider how incredibly different our lives are due to fast air travel, to lose that would have a significant impact. That's kind of scary in both work context and personal travel context. So it's something that I think we should be asking for more work to be done on. Either that or it's helium blimps, and instead of an 8-hour flight time, maybe a 2-week flight time. With Sir Harry Croteau, we talked a bit about the sustainability of doing science, and it's something that working in a developmental biology lab where pretty much everything in there is a petroleum-based product, and for the sake of safety and for the sake of the success of the work, you pretty much need to throw out things all along the way, whether it's pipette tips to rubber gloves to little test tubes, centrifuge tubes, reagents, all of that stuff ultimately goes in the bin for appropriate disposal. But the bottom line is that not only are scientific labs using up these actual pieces of equipment, but they're also burning an incredible amount of energy. And I was really heartened to find out that there is an organization founded in the US that's now beginning to take off in Britain called Labs 21 that is working to address this very problem. Labs 21 is a program that was started by the Department of Energy and the US Environmental Protection Agency. And when the US Environmental Protection Agency, or the EPA, came to report their annual energy consumptions to the US Congress, as they are required to do, the EPA and the Department of Energy, or DOE, went beyond what was required, and they included the energy bills for their various facilities. This was a bit of a shock to everyone because they hadn't expected this information and it was incredibly high. It basically spurred on the initiative of Labs 21, which does a lot of outreach to not only laboratories that have not yet been built, but existing laboratories. They also run annual conference and trade shows to try and get builders involved and aware of the sustainable options to them. And they have lots of institutes on board, both private and public sector. These include Bristol-Myers Squibb, Harvard University, Pfizer Labs, Stanford University, and the University of California. And it includes federal partners such as the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, the Ocean and Atmospheric Administration, and the Renewable Energy Laboratory, and also the National Science Foundation. What's really shocking about all of this is that if you talk to scientists about their own energy consumption and the cost of their work and the impact of their work in terms of CO2 gases and fossil fuel consumption, I think that very, very few of us really think about our work as making a negative impact on climate change. And in fact, there was a study that was done where 400 scientists were pulled across a wide range of disciplines back in August 2006, and 95% agreed that science and technology was important to finding sustainable solutions, but only 40% said that they often or always considered the effect of their work on the environment. And this was a study done by the UK Department of Environment, Food and Rural Affairs. Apparently, one of the highest consumers of energy in a lab are the fume cabinets, machines that you work within that have a very controlled airflow, so your work and you are separated. So you can use all kinds of toxic things in these biological safety cabinets, or a fume hood, which basically just protects your work from the external environment. And because these are always generating flow, they're using up a tremendous amount of energy. Same thing with refrigeration. It's a huge consumer of energy, but it's essential. Fridges and freezers are critical to the success of any laboratory because so many things need to be preserved at these cold temperatures. So Labs 21, which you can go to their website if you're interested. And the website for Labs 21 is www.epa.gov/labs21century or Google Labs 21. What's shocking is that laboratories consume between 5 and 10 times more energy than office buildings. But the trick is that because they're a more rare and diverse beast, it's harder to find generalized solutions to make them more energy efficient. And in fact, if you ask a scientist what his or her energy bill is, I'm sure that you'll get a blank stare. I would have no idea. And in fact, I did contact William Rees, who, with his then PhD student at the time, Mathis Wagernackel, devised the ecological footprint, which if you go to UBC's sustainability website or if you Google ecological footprint, you'll come up with how to calculate your own. But I emailed with him and I asked him about the ecological footprint that laboratories have, and he was stymied too, and with good reason, because to track all of the energy that you use directly or indirectly, even in terms of deliveries, because we order stuff all the time from various companies. We're getting FedEx deliveries, and of course that's using up tons of fossil fuel, plane fuel, truck fuel. So Dr. William Rees wasn't sure either, and that's endemic, and I think it's something that it's obviously possible to do because the Department of Energy and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency did it to a much greater detail than was expected. So it's not unrealistic for us as scientists to do this. We just need to set our minds to it. And in fact, institutionalized checking of energy consumption by labs, I think, is the ideal to shoot for. If you want to get more involved with this or you want more information about this, at least at UBC, you can contact the Sustainability Office. The phone number for that is 604-827-5641. You can also go online to www.sustain.ubc.ca. Another cool topic that I want to just touch on before we wrap up the show, which is very soon, is fuel. Because fuel is, you could say, a central theme to this show and the idea of releasing greenhouse gases and consuming fossil fuels. And of course, hydrogen fuel cells are one option, but another is biodiesel. And biodiesel essentially is a domestic renewable fuel for diesel engines that is derived from natural oils like soybean oil or canola oil or the stuff you get at the back of a chip shop that they use. And it can be used to fuel vehicles. And I wanted to bring up a particular Canadian company. This is a cool little story. It was a company that was founded on the basis of the Master of Science thesis of Edward Beggs back in 1999, so about 8 years ago now. And his thesis was called Renewable Oil Fuels and Diesel Engines as Components of Sustainable System Design. The company was established to research and develop SVO, or straight vegetable oil, kits and related components and equipment that essentially you as a consumer can purchase to transfer your car from a gas-guzzling vehicle to a biodiesel-guzzling vehicle. And in fact, the company, which is called Plant Drive International, is located in Salmon Arm in British Columbia. You can visit Plant Drive by going to www.plantdrive.ca, and online there you can buy kits and components for the complete conversion of diesel engines to 100% vegetable oil as a fuel. And apparently there is no chemical processing or the addition of harmful chemicals involved. Now, I don't own any of this stuff, and I haven't ordered it from the site or spoken with anyone who works with Plant Drive International, so buyer beware. But it's a good place to start. If you have a diesel engine and you want to convert it from using the diesel fuel to a biofuel, which is not only better for the environment, but it's a heck of a lot cheaper, this may be a good place to start. In fact, if you'd like to visit some of the depots that are involved with Plant Drive International, there's one located in Salmon Arm, which is where Ed Beggs, who's the co-owner and the founder, is. It's Plant Drive British Columbia, and the website is www.plantdrive.com, or Dr. Bjorn's Auto, which is located in Cobble Hill in BC. And if you Google it or go to the Plant Drive International website, you can find out the contact details there. I'm in Calgary, so I thought that I would mention for anyone who has friends or family or lives in Alberta that if you go to Canmore, Veggie Power Biofuels, who is, I think, Tori Carlson, who's a PhD, is the one in charge of Veggie Power Biofuels in Canmore, Alberta, and that's www.veggiepower.com. So that's it for today's show. Thanks for listening to My Science Project. I'm your host. Julia Ann is on in another 2 weeks from now. And for those of you who are interested in Café Scientifique, there was a bit of a hiccup with it. I know it was meant to happen on Tuesday the 17th, but unfortunately it fell through. It might be going on Tuesday the 24th, but not quite sure. So you can check the website, which is cafesci-van.com, or contact the Railway Club probably to find out from them, because that's where, of course, Café Scientifique is hosted. So after having said all of that, I will leave you with Prodigy, their song Diesel Power, off the Most Righteous Fat of the Land album.
Lyrics upon the format, filled with skill, with technique, computer ADAT. My lyrical form is clouds on your brainstorm. I get hype, think, thought, flow, acrobat. Sync the track, pump the track, dance missions. Clubs like foes, react by stone visions. Inherited war reflects on the dance floor. Blowing up, in heaven mad people showing up. Packing crowds, jam-packed venues. Needles collapse while atmospheres continue. Sprinkle that, winning like that, moving like that, hitting like that. The melody is fat, your arm on the energy source. The cosmic force, with prodigy, different astrology. My intellect's the power, with diesel power. Blows your mind drastically, fantastically. 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 Wind spin back, rewind, diesel power. Blows your mind drastically, fantastically. It has to be automatically. Check it out, you better work it out. Change to another route. My techniques, strategies, abilities, I leave course to mic, hanging like spring leaves. Do a try so fast, beyond the here and I. Lyrical tactics, vocal gymnastics, eased and pepped up. You get swept up, smacked up, backed up. Your crews are cracked up. Check it slow, pick, choose quick, you can't stick. My medical range is strange as angles. You get tangled, twist inside of fences. Channels repeat, complete, can't compete. Check the hour, texture, mind adventure. Exploit the point, enter tracks to devour. My intellects proceed with diesel power. Blows your mind drastically, fantastically. 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 Back attack the rag, pack you back to me. You don't want none, high quality act to be. Still standing, damaging your other manner. Quick reverse, potent as the first verse. My amplifier blows on your world's higher. World sire, cuts like a barbed wire. Break a plate, I pull up on you every day. Fast forward, I move and I swing forward. Exit load, put your brain in right mode. Select and mix, the man will perfect and fix. Heads lightly, fight me. Copy, Xerox, cock, hand block. You can't knock them out there. Upbeat lifting, shifting, persistent. Intelligent kingpin, flipping astrology. As I roll with prodigy with diesel power. Blows your mind drastically, fantastically. 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 Robot Sonic.
Hey, you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. That was just Prodigy coming off of the last show. I'm Becky, and I'm here tonight from, I guess, 6:05 till 7:30. Theme is live music. Music I've seen live, bands that are playing together, anything that has to do with live music, which hopefully is everything, because what's a band if they're not good live? We're going to start you off tonight with a band I saw this weekend called The Transmitters. And if you are involved with the Vancouver scene, specifically the punk scene, you'll have heard them. They play around a lot. Coming up again, playing with Teenage Head. And I won't tell you who, but there is someone here at CITR who's very directly involved with The Transmitters. And perhaps if you go see them, you will understand why they are such an integral part of our station and why I am so happy to be playing them right now, because their show was very, very wonderful. So catch them coming up with Teenage Head, and here they are.